moves these days. American Buddhism has arrived at a point of establishment while still being formed. Looking at this textbook, at the same time that I've been taking a self-directed crash course in jazz, listening to Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, and on, it got me musing on connections I had not noticed before. Buddhism, racism, and jazz, perhaps the most American of all phenomena. To think about American Buddhism, I suppose you start with Europe, which encountered Buddhism in the 19th century and projected onto it the staid and sober, if tragic, point of view that was then culturally ascendant. This version of Buddhism had a big impact on German thinkers like Schopenhauer, Schleiermacher, and others, and through them on many subsequent thinkers, including Nietzsche, the force of whose thought was a great challenge to European conventional norms. By the early 20th century, European culture, as it had been carried on up until then, was beginning to become frayed. Christianity was less compelling to intellectuals than it had been, and the Great War, which we now call World War I, was a tremendous shock to the system. And all over Europe, intelligent and thoughtful people were questioning their heritage, and many found Buddhism, which seemed psychologically astute and fully compatible with science as Christianity seemed not to be, very intriguing. And a good number of such people, people like Lama Govinda, Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, Nyanaponika Thera, and others, spent the greater part of their lives in Asia, steeped in the languages and traditions of Buddhism, and provided the first European look at Buddhism from the inside. In America, Buddhism was also, if differently, influential by the mid-19th century. Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman were certainly deeply turned by their reading of Buddhism and other Asian classical writings. But unlike in Europe, where there was a long-standing and influential intellectual tradition, the energy of American culture was and is popular and materialistic. Edison, who invented a whole bunch of stuff, is a foundational American cultural figure, as is Henry Ford, who figured out how to manufacture stuff more quickly and efficiently and change the whole world. Our Schopenhauer is maybe George M. Cohan. Our Schleiermacher is maybe Bob Hope. Though the transcendentalists' absorption and Americanization of Buddhism and Asian thought prepared the way for the next great wave of Buddhist influence, the real power behind that wave was not intellectual, it was economic and popular. And it crested a century later in the 1950s and 60s with the explosion of pop culture. The Beats and the Beatles made Buddhism cool. The cultural foment of the period spilled over into big, bold movements rather than thoughtful efforts to translate, digest, and studiously absorb Buddhism. Buddhism was mystical and exotic. Asian thought was wild and poetic, and in almost every way, the obverse of American life in the 1950s. Maybe some of you remember all this. So it's not that Americans, mostly young Americans, understood Buddhism and wanted to take it up. No, exactly because we didn't understand, we could take it up as the answer to an underlying impulse, a contradiction within us that had always been there, but was only in this period beginning to be felt. By the middle 1960s, it was clear that America needed to break out of something. And Buddhism appeared as a way to help us do that. And what I'm contending in this essay is that this impulse, this need to break out, which eventually, as we all know, became a tremendous undercurrent in the culture, had everything to do with the experience of African Americans, a group that was and is marginalized, and yet has been at the same time, from the beginning, at the center of American life and culture, however repressed this centrality has been. More specifically, you could say that the American Buddhist movement began in the late 1940s when Kerouac and Cassidy made their frantic trips across America and kindled what became the Beat Movement. And many of the Beat writers, like Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen, Amiri Baraka, who was at the time called Leroy Jones, Michael McClure, Diane DePrima, and others, these people were really influential cultural figures. Thousands turned out to their readings. They were gurus for the youth movement. And almost all of them were serious practicing Buddhists. And all of them were deeply inspired by African American culture, specifically by jazz. If you read On the Road, you'll find it has a mystical, almost guru-like worship of Black jazz players. Outsiders and iconoclasts, the Beats, who were outside Baraka and a few others, white, naturally identified with that part of American life that was always lively, always embattled, and always underground. I think you can't understand America without understanding jazz. Jazz and blues, its sister, really accounts for all the truly indigenous creativity we have. And when I say indigenous, I mean post-Native American genocide indigenous. When we write the cultural history of America, I think this will be very clear. Jazz was the roar of the 20s as much as it was the howl of the 60s. And all the breakout energy of American culture, the stuff that is exported and lusted after all over the world, comes from or is associated with the energy of jazz, which later morphed into rhythm and blues, which gave birth to rock and roll and pop music. It all comes from jazz. But the jazz of the Beats, the jazz of the late 30s and 40s, was different from what had gone on before. It was more beat than upbeat, as the earlier music had been. The early jazz giants, like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, played their music initially in Black settings for Black audiences, and later became acceptable and even essential to white American audiences, for whom they played graciously, excellently, and mostly happily, without ever expressing the alienation and disconnect that anyone with their life experience would have felt. And it's not that they were unwilling to express it, probably, but that at that moment, it was more or less impossible for the white world to hear it. And they understood that, as did most Black people at the time. But by the late 30s, things were changing. And the younger Black musicians were getting restless, maybe tired of the long silence on race oppression. And they began to reflect this in new forms of music. And this trend accelerated after the Second World War, when many of them came home after fighting side by side with white Americans to find that nothing at all had changed. Racism may not have gotten worse, but it got harder to take. The new breed of musicians, they called them the beboppers, Monk, Parker, Miles, Dizzy, and so on, many, many of them. They wore dark glasses, funny hats, goatees, and they played the music they wanted to play. White audiences were welcome to listen, but the music was not to be compromised for them, as it might sometimes have been in the earlier generation. Many of the white jazz critics definitely did not like it. This great generation of jazz musicians, like their predecessors, were really geniuses of the first rank. And it's really impossible to separate their musical breakthroughs from the cultural and social revolution that went along with them. They knew what they were doing. They understood the forces that had formed America. They saw exactly how the inspiring tale of liberty and justice for all depended on an equal measure of denigration, economic oppression, and invisibility for them, and it always had. They insisted on their Africanness and their historical American bondage as gritty, valuable, and revolutionary facts of life. They owned their imposed marginality, and they made art out of it. And it's no accident, I think, that so many of them died young, in many cases from alcoholism and drugs. And I don't want to romanticize them. Many of them were just unable to contain the passionate, painful energy their music unleashed. What they saw, what they understood, what they expressed burned them up. The African-American experience, in all its painfulness and nobility, so clearly seen and expressed by these jazz players, is not simply that of a minority against whom great wrong has been done. In fact, it is the American experience. It is ours, all of ours, white and black alike. It is and has always been central to who we are as a nation. Therefore, it's crucial for all of us to appreciate and understand it. America still fascinates the rest of the world because it remains a unique social experiment. Anyone's secret childlike wish to start fresh, to begin again from scratch, to have things the way you want them without having to put up with patterns from the past. And you can do this without muss or fuss and with unlimited happiness and freedom for everyone. So the story goes. Anyone who has done meditation practice for any length of time realizes what folly this is. Because the history is in your mind. The cultural patterns are there in you. You can't get away from them. And anyone who's lived a lifetime in a coherent culture with deeply historical roots also knows that this is impossible. The past is everywhere. You can never escape it. Nevertheless, everyone wishes it were possible. And only America has tried it. And it has worked to a tremendous degree. But in order to start over again, you need a place, a fresh new place. Open and empty for you, totally clean slate. And the European colonists, as far as they were concerned, came on a continent that was empty. The mountains, the rivers, the prairies, free for the taking and using. So much for the purpose, the beauty, the rights of Native American life and culture. And if you want to start fresh and progress rapidly, somebody has to carry the suffering that will inevitably be produced by your effort. The suffering that is inherent in the production of anything. You simply can't stop and take care of it as you go along. It slows you down. It dampens the enthusiasm. To keep things moving properly, it is necessary that the weight of that suffering be carried by someone in secret, in the dark, completely out of sight, so that there's no question, whatever, moral or legal, of having to stop for a moment and deal with it. And besides, you need a lot of cheap labor. Hence, the institution of slavery, and in particular, uniquely, the enslavement, not of a conquered people, not of an unfortunate people, economically unfortunate, but of a people totally unknown, from a place as far away as Mars. African Americans from slavery times until World War II carried this psychic as well as social and economic suffering in secret. They were literally invisible to white society. Who they were, what they felt, could not, would not be shown to the white world. It was covered over with cartoon pictures. But after World War II, this invisibility was no longer possible, and the effort to gradually come out of the shadows into the light, an effort that has not yet nearly reached fruition, illuminates not only African Americans, but the white world as well. The slavery practice here was unique because it functioned psychologically as a way to absorb and bury a great cultural pain. Prior to New World slavery, the institution of slavery had degrees of cohesion and logic to it. There was slavery all over the world, always. If you were defeated in battle, if you were destitute and without a family, you could become a slave. But slaves had a place in society. They could be integrated. They had a measure of honor and social status. Greek slaves could become free. They could become scholars, teachers, actors, poets. The children of Roman freedmen, ex-slaves, could become Roman citizens, even senators. Slaves could buy themselves out of slavery or be freed voluntarily by their masters, which also happened from time to time. In American slavery, a freed black person, though, always remained vulnerable and marginal. In cases where whole nations and classes of people were enslaved, they could generally maintain their customs, identity, and language, and they were still people, and they had an above-ground function in society. But this was not the case with African slaves in America. They were not literally viewed as people. Serious literary and pseudoscientific speculation of the day posited all kinds of theories to show that they were an inferior race. In the 19th century, social Darwinism and other forms of evolutionist thought doubled down on this direction, arguing with little serious engagement with Darwin's actual work that African-derived peoples were a degraded subspecies. And as such, they were fortunate to have been brought to a place where they might be improved upon, even eventually Christianized and civilized. To this end, they were outlawed from using their language, playing their music, worshiping their gods, and from reading and writing. Their families were not real families, so they could be broken up as it suited their white owners to do so. Their bodies were not their own, they were brutalized. There was a consistent effort to dismantle them spiritually. These really horrible and unique ongoing effects of the experience of slavery in America are still the dominant factor in the African American experience. That they are so little understood and appreciated is one reason why the African-American culture in all its richness and sadness and complexity seems so baffling to white people. There is simply a tremendous gap in understanding of what is actually going on, what the real nature of the African-American community actually is. I believe and I get this from my own contact with the community, though in a limited way from teaching high school locally, which I did then in 1993, and volunteering to teach meditation in a African-American community daycare center, which I also did in those days. From that little bit of contact, I have become convinced that there is a sanity and a depth in the African-American community that American society as a whole needs to recognize and learn from. White culture has never seen it. It is not available to the camera or to the reporter. It doesn't fit into the journalistic form. We get the problems and the tragedy, which surely are there, but the complexity, the ambiguity, the beauty of the situation never surfaces. White America simply doesn't get it. It doesn't have the eye or the mind or the language to understand. And yet, it's there in the music. African music has the most complex rhythmical structure of any music in the world. It is a music that depends entirely on improvisation, on the body, on the human voice and human feeling, and on sincerity and presence rather than technique, although there's lots of technique. It has values that lean into a kind of friendliness and easy connection with things, not a description of them. Since African captives were not allowed to use their native music in America directly, they created it anew, using American folk and church singing and the conditions of their own lives to craft their own saving way of expression. They made gospel, they made blues, and blues had its origins in the work song or field shout, which later emerged when instruments were introduced as jazz. Jazz as the preeminent product of American denial. Jazz as the distilled elixir of the suffering that has run secretly through the night of the American dream. As Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, says in his book, The Blues People, his classic book, the poor Negro always remembered himself as an ex-slave and used this as the basis of any dealings with the mainstream of American society. The middle-class black man bases his whole existence on the hopeless hypothesis that no one is supposed to remember that for almost 300 years there was slavery in America, that the white man was the master, the black man the slave. This knowledge, however, is at the root of the legitimate black culture of this country. It is this knowledge, with its attendant muses of self-division, self-hatred, stoicism, and finally quixotic optimism, that informs the most meaningful of African-American music. Denial, rage, hurt of all kinds, taking care of karma so buried for so long that you almost can't see it any longer. This is the stuff that Dharma in America seems to be most firmly based on, as far as I can tell. At first, it was the colorful, exotic face of Buddhism that was attractive, that, or the intellectual or aesthetic satisfaction of the teachings and the culture they implied. Everybody was trying to get enlightened, remember that? But beyond this is the very real suffering, often the hidden, unacknowledged suffering that meditation practice brings to the surface, that sustains the practice over time. And I think that to some extent, the sexual abuse and power abuse scandals that have created so much confusion in American Dharma centers over the last 10 years, so this is 1993, I'm talking about the period from 83 to 93, those scandals perhaps came not from any selfish or evil intention on the part of the teachers or the students, but rather from a failure to understand this point, a failure to appreciate, in other words, the fragility and hurt that are so central to the personal experience of so many Dharma students. And this is why I'm arguing that African American people are in fact our ancestors in the American Dharma as much as, and probably more than, Padmasambhava, Buddha Ghosha, and Huainan. We've come to Buddhism in the end, I believe, not because we had some mystical transport or deep faith or understanding. We've come to it because we need it. And we can't go on any longer without it. American Buddhist groups are now at the point of looking around and noticing, remember it's 1993, that there are no dark faces in the meditation halls. And they're wondering why this is so and trying to figure out what to do about it. This is true, at least in the San Francisco Bay Area, where a few interracial Buddhist convocations have been organized to look at this issue. It's traditional to point out that it takes a body, leisure to practice, and an encounter with the teachings in order to begin to practice in any given lifetime. A good number of white middle-class Americans have these requisites. Probably fewer African Americans do. And even if they did, would they be interested in participating in a movement that looks like it is predominantly white and therefore likely not really open to African Americans? This is something the American Buddhist movement needs to work on over time to make sure that they are fully available to everyone, African American people and all others. But what's crucial to me as a white American practicing Buddhism is that to understand myself as a Buddhist practitioner, or for that matter, as an American, I have to understand the African American experience. African American people have understood the roots and branches, the dynamics and undercurrents of America. They've understood it. They've been formed by it. In turn, they have formed it, and they have expressed it in many ways. But white America has not heard these expressions because its ears have been shut by long habit, ignorance, and willful avoidance. It's as if the language that could communicate the Black experience to white people has not yet been invented. Inventing a language requires that you first recognize the need for one, that you feel the pain of separation, the need to reach out. And out of such need, perhaps not yet felt by white America, but it will be one day, will come first inarticulate grunts, noises, gestures, and then a question and a hope. And then finally, a willingness to truly see what you couldn't see before, to acknowledge your fear, guilt, and shame, to admit in shock and horror that the immense sins of the past are not left in the past, they continue into the present, and that you did not wish to know this in such difficult yet necessary ways. A language is invented to reach across so that for the first time it is possible for white people to begin to comprehend what it means to be an African American, at least to whatever extent this is conceivable. And to whatever extent it is, it will, to that same extent, become possible for white people to begin to see themselves. For white Buddhists who know that the first noble truth is all conditioned existence has the nature of suffering, this self-seeing must be the beginning and the essence of the path. So that's my 1993 essay, which I removed many factual errors, many things that misconceptions that I had had about African American history. I don't know about you, but the accelerated learning over the last, I don't know, 6 to 10 years has been enormous. We now, all of us, know a lot of stuff we didn't know before. And the more we know, the more kind of horrifying it gets, frankly.